Good afternoon. My name is Henk Voesten. I'm working at Altera, Wageningen University and Research Center in Wageningen in the Netherlands. And I'd like to talk this afternoon about soil physics and the wise use of tropical peatlands. I don't know if this will make sense in the end, but I'm working more in tropical peatlands and then find out that also the soil physical aspects are quite important and we know rather little about them. In the developed world, it's already a problem to get good physical properties, water retention and hydraulic conductivity curves. Even more so when you're working in the tropics. It's a real problem. There are hardly any data and it's difficult to measure them as well. But at the same time, they are quite important when you look into these systems, which I will try to explain. Peatlands worldwide, they are very important reservoirs of water, biodiversity, and carbon. They are reservoirs of water because they store a lot of rainfall and they slowly release that to the environment. They are important reservoirs of biodiversity. When we look to Southeast Asia, they form one of the last habitat of the orangutans, and there are many other plants and animals found in these tropical peatlands. Lastly, they are also very important stores of soil carbon. Worldwide, there is something like 550 gigaton of carbon stored in peatlands. That means in tropical peatlands, boreal and temperate peatlands. And in the tropics, we'll find about 10% of that, something like 55 gigaton of carbon stored in these peatlands. Peatlands in the tropics are different from peatlands in the boreal and in the temperate zone in the sense that the plant-forming vegetation, of the peat-forming vegetation in the tropics is a forest, a peat-formed forest, whereas in the temperate and in the boreal zone, those are mainly swachnum species and mosses. Because it's a forest in the tropics, also these physical properties of peatlands in the tropics are quite different. Peatlands in Southeast Asia did hit the headlines in the newspapers every now and then, especially because you have these huge fires. Here in this center picture, you see the island of Borneo. The northern part, this is Malaysia, and the southern part of the island of Borneo is called Kalimantan, the Indonesian part of it. And every year, or almost every year, you have peat fires in these areas. And they cause a lot of problems for the local people, health problems, the economy gets to a halt, and it causes also a lot of pollution to the environment. Huge amounts of CO2 are released to the air, and it means often that the airports in Singapore and in Kuala Lumpur have to be closed. So it gives also quite a bit of political tension in the area. When we look at the hydrology of peat swamps, this is an overall picture. On the top one, we can see that these peat swamps actually have a dome shape. They are somewhat more elevated in the middle, and to the left and to the right, they drain towards rivers, and it's underlain by a mineral subsoil. In these peatlands in Southeast Asia, precipitation is something like 3,000 millimeters per year. About half of that returns back to the atmosphere as evapotranspiration, and the remaining 1,500 millimeters is drained sideways to these rivers or to the drainage canals, and only a very small proportion of it is percolated into the deeper peat layers. So we, in these systems, often talk about a two-layered system of an acrotelm and a catotelm. And this acrotelm, this is then very badly or hardly decomposed peat material, which has a very high hydraulic conductivity of something like 30 meters per day. Whereas the deeper catotelm, then it goes down to 10 meters per day. The problem identification, we are again here on the island of Borneo, and then in the southern tip of it, central Kalimantan. Something like 50% of the global tropical peatlands are found in Indonesia. It means an area of something like 13 million hectares, and some 3 million hectares of those are found in Kalimantan. In the past, and also still ongoing, is illegal logging in the area. People take out the timber because it's high value. They make a lot of money for it, but they have to drain the peatlands in order to get the wood out. And also, in the past, in the mid-90s, Indonesia started a large scheme, the so-called 1 million hectare mega rice project area in central Kalimantan, where they started draining large areas to convert these peatlands into agricultural land in order to produce rice for the rest of Indonesia. This has now stopped, this agricultural use more or less of the peatlands in terms of rice production, but there is a new pressure on these systems, and that is that many of these peatlands are nowadays drained in order to grow oil palm. And this oil palm is then produced for the markets in Europe as a biofuel. In this picture here, we see two different systems. In the center part, it's the Sabango peatland area, which is a relatively intact peat swarm forest area. It's something like 200,000 hectares. And to the right of it, we see a part of this 1 million hectare project area, which has been drained, and you can see the different drainage canals in it in the mid-90s in order to make agricultural land from them. Now, as soon as you start draining these peatlands, you lower the water table, you get oxygen in your profile, and the peat starts to oxidize and will release CO2 to the atmosphere. Now, that's happening from normal agriculture practices, but there is also another effect that if you drain too deep, these peatlands become very vulnerable to fires. So that would be then another second cause of CO2 emissions in addition to the regular oxidation of the peat. In controlling this whole thing, management of groundwater levels is crucial. Under natural conditions, these groundwater levels are close to soil surface. That's the natural system. Under those circumstances, this peat swarm forest thrives optimal. It will sequester carbon from the atmosphere, and the peat layer will grow at a rate of something like 1 millimeter per year. Now, these systems are something like 20,000 years old. That means that the total peat layer found in these areas is something like 15 to 20 meters of peat. So that's a considerable thickness of peat buildup in these layers. Okay, what we did, that is we did hydrological modeling for these large areas, try to model groundwater levels for the areas. And in order to do that, you need several layers of input. This is information on land use, on rainfall, evapotranspiration, surface water system. The topography of the area is very important. And this is still quite difficult to get good data because these areas are difficult to assess. You cannot easily go into it, so you have to rely often on remote sensing data to get good input data for your modeling. A result is presented here on the figure. The graph on the right-hand side shows groundwater levels for the 15th of July in the year 1997, which was a very dry year. What we see here, that is that the green area, which corresponds roughly with the intact peat swarm forest area of the Sabango, this has groundwater levels, say, between 0 and 40 centimeters, whereas the drained agricultural area has water levels deeper than this 40 centimeters. On the left-hand side, we see a hotspot map showing areas which were on fire at this same date. And when you do an overlay of these two maps, they correspond really well. And that's an indication that these groundwater levels of 40 centimeters are a kind of threshold value beyond which the fire risk increases dramatically. Now, we were thinking about it. How can we understand this process? And then, first this graph. This critical depth was confirmed also in other studies, where we see here fluctuations of groundwater levels for different years. And again, this depth of 40 centimeters proved to be a critical value below which you would have fire. To understand this whole process, we come to the conclusion that this water retention curve of the peat is very important. Here we see three curves for peat at different degrees of humification. When we talk about the very raw peat material, the fibric stuff, it's this yellow line. When it gets more haemic, it's the orange one, and the brown one is more for the sapric peat. Now, when it's a relatively young system, this curve for the fibric applies the yellow one, and when you apply to these systems a suction of, say, 40, 50 centimeters, you will see that it loses all its water quite rapidly because it's still so undecomposed and there is it's woody, coarse material, so it doesn't hold any water. So as soon as you drain it for 40, 50 centimeters, it will lose its water and it will form a dry layer of 1 or 2 meters, which easily will catch fire either by lightning or by people throwing cigarettes away or other ways. So this physical property is most likely a reason that the system is so vulnerable to drainage when it comes to fires. Of course, this humification is an ongoing process. So once we are first in the fibric phase, and then it will move on to the haemic and the sapric, and we are still looking for ways to mimic this change in hydraulic properties with time, because that's what we are really seeing here. It's not a constant thing in time, but it's changing over time. Maybe you have some suggestions how we could do this. There are also great yearly variations. In a relatively wet year, hardly any of the area gets below this threshold value of 40 centimeters, only 2%. And an average year is something like 23%. And in this dry El Nino year, it's something like 40% of the area, which is very susceptible to fire. You also can see on these three slides that to the left, this Sebango peatland area is really relatively little at risk. It also shows good resilience. It comes back to its wet status, whereas this drained peatlands to the right of it, they remain dry and they will be vulnerable to fire for a long period. This is for different years. Also, when you look in a single year, this is again this El Nino year, 1997, we see big differences from month to month. It's quite wet up till July, but then it starts drying out. And July, August, September, October, more than 90% of the area is beyond this critical threshold of 40 centimeters. And this is, of course, a reflection of the rainfall pattern in these areas, where we have a distinct wet season and a distinct dry season. Now, some conclusions. Hydropedological modeling of groundwater levels identifies potential hotspot fire risk areas, as well as promising vegetation restoration areas in an eco-hydrological approach. So this whole hydrology of this peatland is key to its wise use. It could be on the bad side when it becomes susceptible to fire, but it's also indicating which areas are doing well or which areas are very promising for vegetation restoration. Because these peatlands, they are in a changing situation. Up till now, we were going to drain them to make useful agricultural land out of them. But now with the whole issue of carbon, they have a value in itself. And new environmental schemes like RED, reduced emission of degradation and deforestation, and carbon credit issues, make that these peatlands become more valuable, and that people in the area could maybe also derive money from these peatlands by keeping them in a good condition and be keeping them as a sink of CO2. Now, in this whole thing, this whole physical characteristics of peat at different degrees of humidification are important predictors of fire, of restoration potential, and of ecosystem resilience behavior of these tropical peatlands. It's not only the soil physics, but it's the soil physics integrated with the hydrology of the area, and that together with the ecology of the area that determines what's going on in these systems. The hydrology and the soil physics, they have large effects on the quality and survival success of vegetation cover, and thereby on re-establishing and maintaining above and below ground ecosystem carbon storage. So by looking into these physical aspects, soil physical characteristics, we get a better understanding of how the system works, and then we can also manage the system in a more wisely way. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hank. Any questions from the audience? Yes.
I just wonder if they've had any consideration of controlled drainage as an option for that area, where you can have the level of water table controlled at different depths at different times of the year.
Yeah, there is a lot of emphasis on, especially on these plantation holders and on all palm plantation holders. They are very much aware that they should maintain relatively shallow, constant water levels. Still means oxidation of your peat, but you're able to minimize it. Yeah.
Since there was a tie, let's also listen to your question.
Yes. How about the hydroponicity? That kind of peat get dry and will show that the strong hydro water liquidancy, and that may affect the hydrology.
Could you explain a little bit more? Yeah.
Okay. I'm asking that the water liquidancy of the peat soil.
Hydrophobicity.
Yeah,
okay.
That, you said that get dry, then the peat will show that the strong hydro liquidancy.
Yeah.
Then that may affect the hydrology. Yeah, how about in that?
No, that's true. As soon as you start draining this peat, you lose some by oxidation, and the other component is the shrinkage of the peat, which is the irreversible drying of the peat. So even if you would re-wet that peat, it would not come back to its original wet situation. Yeah, that's correct.